thank you, Lisa. You don't really want me to take this through 200 and something pages, or at least not in a few minutes. But thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction, and also thank you very much to you and to NGLS that together with the other co-sponsors, Amnesty International, Global Policy Forum, Friede Herbert Stiftung, helped put this meeting together in a difficult week where there is enormous demand for the attention of everybody here for room spaces and even with difficulties to get from one place to the other. But really, thank you very much, and thanks a lot for the support that has been provided to Natalia, that as has been said. Natalia Cardona is starting recently to be Social Watch permanent representative here in New York, so we hope that you all help her. I also want to thank the funders of the report and of this work, which include Oxfam NOBIB, the European Commission, and the Ford Foundation, none of which are responsible for what the report says. That's the disclaimer that we have to also put everywhere. But really, thanks for the people that believe that this is a worthwhile exercise. As far as I know, it's also probably the first or one of the first attempts to try to look at the crisis from the other angle, even when in these very days the Secretary General has just coming out with his own report on the voices of the vulnerable. That's the official name, which we feel very proud that it's so similar to our People's Voices event of that we organized in June, parallel to the high-level conference on the crisis. I think we those efforts to try to reflect people's voices and not just people's as victims of the crisis is really worthwhile. And it's important that the angle is in that direction. And in that sense, I think that the UN is in this aspect really on the right path. Now, when we look at the crisis from below, and you will find in the report 61 different national reports coming from as many countries done by the Social Watch coalitions from around the world with a variety of different expertises and experiences, but they are bringing in their testimonies about the crisis, the impact, and their proposals around it. And one of the things that you find, or that I found very interesting in reading through all those 60 reports, is that the world is not as orderly as when it looks like when you see it from here or from Washington or Brussels or the UNCTAD offices in Geneva or whoever is analyzing the crisis. Impact of the crisis on the poor so far has been a kind of exercise, which is, I think, very important, of saying, okay, if the economy is suffering recession and GDP is shrinking so much, therefore so many jobs will be lost at the other end of the chain, which, fine, or trade will be reduced in as much, or poverty of under $1 a day will increase in that many millions of poor people. And you have all kinds of those figures being thrown around and circulated. But basically, it's the same exercise. You put some global numbers on one end, and you get results on the other one. Now, we don't have similar numbers to propose We don't have a similar counting coming up from the grassroots, but we have the strong impression that it's even worse. And also the impression is it has to be much worse than what is being told from those exercises. Of course, then I should explain why. And that comes from our analysis and the reports that are coming from the people as to how it actually works on the ground. Social Watch from Peru says when commodity prices were up and we were having growth and the economy was booming, we were being told to be patient for that to trickle down to the people. Now that all this is being collapsed, we are being told to tighten our belts. In that sense, the result is the same. When you see at the policy responses, as reported here by the people in the countries, which have the crisis as an excuse, there is a crisis, therefore we do this, we do that. There is an enormous variety of real policy responses in the real countries. In Thailand, for example, which should know about financial crisis because that's where the crisis started in Southeast Asia not that many years ago, they came to the conclusion that there was a problem with the regulation of the financial sector. Therefore, we will deregulate. Sorry? Yeah, that's the policy response. So many countries, with the excuse of the crisis, are deregulating, privatizing, speeding up the process to join the WTO, which implies liberalizing even more, while other countries are stopping privatization plans, are trying to get hold of the financial sector, are trying to regulate, are trying to look at how the contagion happens and address those issues. Internally in the countries, which is policies at the end of the day, are a result of society and the forces struggling in that society. Of course, this crisis mobilizes all kinds of different forces, which then demand policies to address that. And so we have, for example, in Paraguay, the soybean planters mobilized very rapidly to demand from the government subsidies and support because the prices of soybean had fallen down from $600 per ton to $400 per ton, which is a dramatic drop in the prices. Poor people, poor guys, until you learn that their production cost is $20 per ton. They're still making lots and lots of money selling at $400. And like in Argentina, they don't pay any taxes. And they are expanding over agricultural lands and making the food products that people actually eat more expensive because they are less abundant now. And still they pressure. They didn't get in Paraguay the subsidy that they were requesting. But they did get in Argentina tax exemption, for example. I met recently with other social watchers, with a prime minister in an African country, and Prime Minister was saying, well, you know, because of the crisis, I am meeting every day with delegations of the business sector, and what they are complaining is that they are lacking competitiveness. Now, all around the third world and also in many developed countries, everybody knows what that means. When the business sector complains about lack of competitiveness, That means salaries have to come down, or that means there has to be flexibility, reduction in workers' rights, or what have you. And so we come to a situation like the one we had in Uruguay, for example, in a roundtable debate in the crisis with social movements and so on, where some delegates from the unions, you know, were like completely downplaying the importance of the crisis. You know, yeah, that's really a big problem over there, but not for us. And that was not the same panel I was in, so I didn't have to engage in a public debate, but at the end we drink a coffee, we discuss. What do you mean? You mean you know the crisis is serious? He says, yes, but who's benefiting? Who is going to really have the capacity to extract policies out of the government with the pretext of the crisis in their favor? And that is usually, you know, or the fear was that the entrepreneurs will get more access than the workers. And that is also one of the reasons, when you look at it through the different countries, why women, for example, are suffering much more from the crisis, even more than what we think about. Because we know all those mechanisms where the informal sector in which women are overrepresented, so to say, or the care economy is overwhelming the crisis because the state is not as protective as it was or as it should, because of budget cuts, because of unemployment, because even the increase in domestic violence and all the different problems that have been identified and written about. But then there is one additional problem, which is the lack of political power and influence to shape the policies to confront the crisis. And so other sectors which are more structured, which are more organized, which have more of a capacity to influence, get there first. And because the crisis, in a way, the image that I get reading through all the 60 reports of the crisis, it's like a brawl in the saloon in those westerns, you know, where fight starts on the poker table, and then all of a sudden, after a while, everybody is fighting against each other, and somebody takes the opportunity to leave without paying, and the guy that was over there goes and kicks the guy that was at the other end because he had stolen his PLC or whatever, which had nothing to do with the poker game when it all started. But in the middle of that confusion, you know, people get away with what they would wanted anyhow. And the reply has to be fast and emergency and energetic. And billions and trillions of dollars are spent in very much unaccountable ways in the name of the crisis and the need to act fast. Now, and then our question is, okay, but how does that, at the end, benefit the vulnerable women, workers, people living in poverty? And the answer is, it doesn't if you don't design explicit policies aimed at that. It does not just by reviving the economy and getting back with business as usual. First, because it's never revived as it was before, because in the meantime you do have to spend that money somewhere, and how it is being spent, who gets the benefits, and so on. It starts with those that really have more access. Yes, there are some cases, there are examples, and so on, where people living in poverty, women, are specific targets of specific policies to at least protect, help, so on. And some of them are described here. Some of them are in effect, and others are being demanded by civil society organizations. In the combination of the financial and economic crisis, the food crisis, and climate, the role of rural women, for example. And it comes out from the demands of civil society and of social watch groups in many different countries that one way or the other, what they are demanding has to do with the protection and promotion of rural women and traditional agricultural forms and communities and so on, of which that is a tool. Yes, it's directly related, even when the link it is not always so clearly made. But the warning and the notion that I had in reading all that input was, oh, it's got to be worse than what is reported, because the modeling that happens when it comes to what are the consequences and the cost of the crisis, which are not coming from actual research on the ground, but from that modeling, ignore those factors. And putting them in makes for a different result, even if we are not in a condition to quantify that. Then the what to do about it precisely relates with that, which is how do we amplify, defend, and support those voices. And that is precisely what this Social Watch report attempts to do. That is what many others, of course, it's not the only effort and probably not by far the most important one, but that's where we want to contribute, which is into making those voices heard, making them influential, giving them the legitimacy that they need, giving them the validity that they need to have to be validated as real important findings and contributions to therefore be able to shape those policies. And I think in this regard, the role of the United Nations has no possible substitution. No matter how important other ad hoc groups might be, as you know, the one that is meeting in Pittsburgh right now or ending the meeting right now, really, that is something that is not you are not going to find in the report, but it's the testimony that in this process I have heard from government officials in G20 countries, like some in South America, very near where I live, which they say we have no clue how to make our voice heard in the G20. We have no clue who is preparing which documents. Where do our proposals fit in? How do we do to put them in the agenda? And then if we manage to get that formulated and accessible to somebody, what kind of process makes that appear or disappear from the final document? We don't know. That's not the civil society. That's the people that are supposed to be preparing the outcome. So the level of frustration with this kind of bodies, even within them, is enormous. Yesterday, the Dutch Prime Minister kind of volunteered himself to represent the voice of the poor countries in the G20. Fine. I mean, that's a generous offer. But don't those countries have their own voice and their own flag? You know, it is over there, you know, and mechanism and transparent mechanisms and legitimacy and so on for them to be heard. So that is why we think that our hope lies in G192 much more than in any other G groups. But that's I think another question, and that is even part of a debate that will go on after this debate ends, and I am supposed to invite everybody, and I do it very gladly, which is a debate precisely about strategizing and thinking about MDGs, human rights, and so on, that Mary Robinson and Amnesty International are organizing immediately after this event, a couple of blocks from here. And I think it will be, I guess many people from here are going to go over there. So that's, I think, the message. Sorry for having talked much more than what I thought I wanted to. Thank you very much for coming here. And we'll have a debate and then some coffee and so on for a more informal debate. Thank you again very, very much.
Thank you, Roberto, for giving us a taste of the report. And again, I'd like to commend Social Watch for the wealth of information that you will find from the impact of the crisis on the ground and how it's been felt, to all these policy recommendations from Algeria to Canada, Costa Rica, Paraguay, Hungary, India. So really, it's a thick report, but I think there's a wealth of information here that can be used to inform the strategies that NGOs are using and developing these days on how to react to the crisis and how to react to what's being decided in various fora, whether it's across the street or in Pittsburgh, in Istanbul soon with the IMF.